Nehemiah chapter 13 again. Nehemiah chapter 13. And how many of us know another language enough to speak? Does anybody know a language they can speak fluently? And Pig Latin doesn't count. German. Very good. Very good. How many of you would like to learn a language and speak it? Oh, well, I think we all would, right? And there's a lot of different ways you can learn languages now, right? Of course, you can do it the formal way and go to a class and, you know, sit through and try to learn from your teacher. And, you know, I've had several classes in Spanish, of course. I think I've taken some in French and some Russian speaking classes and didn't do too well. I've got them all mixed up. I knew Spanish until I went to Quebec on a church mission trip, and that messed me all up completely. So I would get the French and the Spanish all mixed up. And I've taken some Greek classes and just a small amount of Hebrew classes. And that's not a spoken language, but it's more of a written language. And so I was able to learn some of those things. But I'd love to be able to speak other languages. And so going to the classes sometimes would help. You can get tapes now where you can listen to the languages and just sort of go over it and over it and over it and over it. Immerse yourself in it until you can actually speak and think in the language. A really good way to learn languages is just travel to other countries and learn those languages, because then you really are immersed in their cultures. But there are some languages, and really there's some language in each language that you really shouldn't want to learn, right? Because every single country and in every single language that there is, there are words and there are phrases that you will not want to learn. There are words and phrases that are immoral. They have a bad connotation. There are words and phrases that are insensitive to others that you just want to stay away from. Otherwise, that's how the Americans get the reputation they do overseas. We want to make sure that we stay away from language that is irreverent. We want to make sure that the language we learn is not coarse or rude. And this happens in every language and also in English. And so even if you have no desire or aspiration to learn another language, there is some language in our own English language that we need to stay away from, especially as Christians. You see, for a Christian, we need to recognize that the Bible has a lot to say about our speech. The word conversation that we looked at in 1 Peter talks about lifestyle, but there are specific places throughout the Bible to talk about the very words that we say. It all starts in one of the Ten Commandments in Exodus chapter 20, verse 7, where the Lord says here, "Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain." It's talking about your speech, isn't it? So we need to be careful what we say. And then he adds, "For the Lord will not hold him guiltless that takes his name in vain." You see, saying God's name in vain with our words is a very, very big issue. The speech of a Christian matters. Your speech in the language that you have, it doesn't matter what language you know, if you say words or phrases that are wrong, that are unbiblical, that are immoral, that are irreverent, or even are just coarse and rude, it has a lot to do with your testimony to the world. You see, words matter. Words really matter. And in the New Testament, there's one section that really addresses the issue of our speech and of our tongue. Keep your finger in Nehemiah, if you will, and go back with me to James chapter 3. You're probably already familiar with this passage. But James shows us the power of the tongue. It has great power for good, as well as great power for evil. And so we want to make sure that we are using our tongues and our speech in the right way and in the best way possible. And in James chapter 3, we're going to read beginning verse 1 through verse 18. He says, "My brethren, do not be many masters, knowing that we will receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all. But if any man offend not in word," that's logos, that's the speech that comes out of our mouth. If you don't offend in word, he basically says, you're like a perfect man, and you're able also to bridle the whole body. If you've got your speech under control, James is saying, more than likely, you've got the rest of your life under control as well. That is how difficult it is to control our tongue. And then verse 3, "Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths so that they will obey us. And then we turn about their whole body." Because a mouth and a tongue, even though it's a little member, has great power and potential. Verse 4, "Behold also the ships, which even though they're so great and are driven by fierce winds, yet the ship is turned about with a very small helm or a rudder, whithersoever the governor or the pilot lists or wants to go. Then he says this, relating to the tongue, to our speech, to our words. Even so, the tongue is a little member and boasteth great things. Behold, how great a matter a little fire can kindle. And the tongue is a fire, he says, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defiles the whole body and sets on fire the course of nature. And if we say evil things, it is set on fire of hell. For of every kind of beast, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind, but the tongue can no man tame. It is unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith, with our tongue, bless we God, even the Father, which is a good thing, but therewith also we curse men, which are made after the similitude or likeness of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not so to be. Does a fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? No. Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries? No. Or either a vine, figs? Of course not. So can no fountain yield both salt water and fresh. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. So we see here that we need to be careful what we say. He goes on, verse 14, but if you have bitter envy and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth, because that wisdom descends not from above, but is earthly and sensual and devilish. For where envy and strife is, there is confusion in every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, and then peaceable and gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy, and the fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Verse 17 shows us the kind of speech that we ought to have with our tongue. So, the children's song that we grew up singing is so true. Oh, be careful, little mouth, what you say. Oh, be careful, little mouth, what you say. The speech of a Christian matters, because words are important. Now back to Nehemiah 13. The people of God, remember Nehemiah 13 is a list of problems. And we come to the fifth problem that Nehemiah had to deal with when he returned back from Babylon after taking a period of time. We don't know exactly how long he was gone to go back to the king as cupbearer. But he came back and he finds problem after problem after problem after problem after problem. And actually there's one more after this. So it keeps coming down to problems. Well, the people of God had another problem, and this time their problem was dealing with their speech. Just like we saw in James. If you can control your tongue, you're pretty well going to be able to control everything else in your life as well. But here we have them dealing with their speech, beginning verse 23. Nehemiah 13, 23. In those days, Nehemiah says, also I saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod and Ammon and of Moab. That sounds kind of familiar. Familiar problem. But then it got worse. Verse 24, and their children, the children from these marriages, spake half in the speech of Ashdod, and could not speak in the Jews' language, but according to the language of each people. So they were losing their national Hebrew language. Then verse 25, and Nehemiah didn't like what he saw or heard, and I contended with them, and cursed them, and smote certain of them, and plucked off their hair, and made them swear by God, saying, you will not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons, or for yourselves. Didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him who was beloved of his God. And God even made him king over all Israel. But nevertheless, even him did outlandish or strange foreign heathen women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God in marrying strange wives? The children of God here were speaking a different language than what they were supposed to know. They were in fact speaking the language of their mothers, which was the language of the world. The language of the Ashdodites and the Ammonites and the Moabites, the language of the world was not to be out of their mouth. It was not to come out of their tongue. Rather, it was supposed to be the Hebrew language that the parents were supposed to pass down. Wouldn't it be strange if we had a person in our midst where they married someone from another country and they taught their child that language but not the native English language? Which is what the responsible parent would do, because that's why we live and breathe in this country. And so that was going on in Israel at this time. And we're going to see tonight that the language of the world is not just a problem with spoken words. It's not just learning German or learning French or Spanish. It's not just a problem with written words. Some people are able to read other language, but may not be able to understand it. But rather, this problem is talking about a spiritual issue in the heart. You see, even though they were speaking a different language, it was really a symptom of something else that was going on in their hearts and in their lives. The worldly language was a problem, but it wasn't the only problem. Verse 23, Nehemiah again saw these Jews that had married wives of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab, these cities that they were not supposed to marry people from, and their children spake half of the speech of Ashdod and of the language of each people, and they could not speak in the Jews' language. When people who say they know the Lord start to sound like the world in their words, we're going to see that it is a symptom of some greater spiritual issues. You see, the tongue is a thermometer of our spiritual condition. How I say things or what comes out of my mouth will reveal a lot about me, not on the outside, but on the inside. You can tell a lot about a person by the words that they say and the words that they use. And it reveals some things. It's a symptom of something deeper. You know, we want to make sure that our kids are saying the right things. We want to make sure that our kids don't swear. We want to make sure that they don't take the Lord's name in vain. We want to make sure that they stay away from coarse language. We want to make sure that they don't use words that are vulgar. We want to make sure that the right kind of speech comes out of their mouth. But when it does come out of their mouth, it's not some, most of the time, it's not an innocent thing. When they're children, it might be. But as they grow older, very often what comes out of their mouth comes from the deepness of their heart. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh, the Lord said. And so what we see here is that if we have the language of the world in our life, just like they did, it reveals the deep resilience of sin. Sin is something that is absolutely resilient. It keeps coming back and coming back and coming back. If sin is not killed, it will keep coming back. And that is the same thing that we see in the life of the children of Israel. Didn't Nehemiah just deal with a similar issue that we saw here in verse 23? What does it say? Nehemiah saw Jews that had married wives of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab. Now, as I was reading through this, that sounded familiar because it was. You see, he had come back, and in the very first part of this chapter, he already dealt with people that had married women from Moab and Ammon. Look back at chapter 13, verse 1. On that day, they read in the book of Moses in the audience of the people, and therein was found written that, here we go, the Ammonite and the Moabite should not come into the congregation of God forever. And then verse 3 it says, now it came to pass when they had heard the law that they separated from Israel all the mixed multitude. So here he had already dealt with this. Most likely this was in the city of Jerusalem itself. It may have been one of the first things that he dealt with when he got back to Jerusalem. And now, as the governor again of all of Judah, he's starting to see and hear things going on, not just in the city of Jerusalem, but in the outskirts of Jerusalem, all throughout Judah. They've got the same problem. They didn't listen and learn to how he dealt with it in the first part of this chapter, and they're still doing it. Sometimes when we are dealing with sin, if we don't kill it, it's going to come back over and over again. This sin, which was already similar to one that Nehemiah dealt with, grew out of the previous sin. And so with these languages of Ashdod and Ammon and Moab, they were learning the language of the world. I like how Raymond Brown puts it. He said, yesterday's enemies, and remember, Ammon and Moab and even Ashdod were enemies of the people of God. So what business were these people of God to have in marrying these people from these countries that were their enemies? Now, Moab and Ammon may not have been recent enemies, but Ashdod, all throughout the time of Israel, remained independent. For a time, they might have been suppressed by a later king, but most of the time, Ashdod, a city on the Mediterranean Sea, was relatively independent, and they were a thorn in the side of the people of Israel. And so he says, yesterday's enemies have become today's marriage partners. That shouldn't happen. And then he says this, there is more than one way to destroy a city. Remember, that was the ultimate purpose of the enemies that surrounded Jerusalem. They didn't want the walls to be raised because they wanted to completely destroy the city of Jerusalem. They didn't want it there. And then after they built those walls, then they were really upset. But then they found other ways to infiltrate and other ways to take down that city. We need to be alert to sin like this. Because when we have words that come out of our mouth that reflect the language of the world, it shows that there is a deep resilience of sin. Sin can and will come back if we're not prepared. If you've ever been down to the South, there is a plant called kudzu. Anybody know what that is? Kudzu is a curse and a blight in the South. It was originally used for erosion control along the side of highways. They brought it in. They imported it from Japan. And they thought it was a great vine to be able to keep things from eroding along the highways. But because of the climate down there, it was so hardy and so strong that it literally could take over not just the side of the highway, but it could take over trees. It could take over telephone poles and lines. It could take over entire forests. And it blocks out the sun. It creeps up and it completely chokes off the life-needing sun that those trees and forests need. And it really has become a blight all throughout the South. And I originally thought it was kind of pretty when I first went down there. But then they said, no, 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 that's a curse down here. We don't like it. But that's what sin does. If we are not alert to it, those sins that we think that we have licked are going to come back because sin is resilient in us. Because on our flesh dwells no good thing, and we need to constantly be before God. And very often, the very first symptom of the sin that's trying to creep back up is our words. Our words. We need to watch what we say and listen to even to what we say and how we say things, because that is a thermometer of what's going on here. And we need to deal with that too. The worldly language seen in these verses was just a symptom that sin was hanging on. You see, the symptom of worldly language reveals the deep resilience of sin, but it also reveals the disappointing reach of sin. The sin of these parents is really what Nehemiah was getting to. It was the sin of the parents in marrying these foreign women that led to these children learning this foreign language, the language of the world. And we see that the sin of the parents did not just affect them. This is something that we must never forget. Sin has a disappointing reach. It reaches to people that we would have never wanted it to reach. It reaches to people that we would have never intended it to reach. Here we find it reaching to their children. Look at verse 24. It says, and their children spoke half in the speech of Ashdod and could not speak in the Jews' language. It wasn't so much because they had friends from these other cities and other nations. It was because their parents had sinned that led to this symptom of them learning the language of the world. And so parents must remember this lesson. It doesn't matter how old you are as a parent. A parent must remember this lesson because our sins affect our families. And not only does it affect our families, our sins will ultimately affect society and the culture in which we live. Because the sins that we pass down from generation to generation will ultimately affect the society and the culture that we live. Because our children are certainly the future. And so this worldly language that these children were speaking revealed a disappointing reach. The parents thought, hey, I've got this under control. I love this person. I love this wife. We were able to have some great advantage to this arrangement and to this situation. But they forgot about the children that would come into that family. They forgot about the importance of making sure that they were reared in a God-fearing home, teaching them the Word of God, teaching them the law of God, teaching them that there is a difference between the speech of a child of God and the speech of someone in the world. There ought to be a difference. But then we also see this symptom revealing the dangerous results of sin. The dangerous results of sin. How did the sin of the parents affect the children? Once again, it showed up in the language. Verse 24 again. All their children spake in the speech of Ashdod. So basically it's teaching here that about half of the kids could only speak the language of the Ashdodites or the Moabites or the Ammonites. And that's all they could speak. The other half, maybe the parents, the father was able to teach them the Jewish language, the Hebrew language. But here, half of these kids could not speak in the Jews' language. But they were able to speak and understand in the language of the other people. The fathers here obviously did not fulfill their responsibility in training their children to learn about the Jewish language. But then we also see these mothers, these foreign mothers, obviously were not fulfilling their opportunities and their responsibilities to their husbands in deferring to them, especially in the areas of religious worship. But instead, the mothers clung to their own people, clung to their own customs, clung to their own gods, and it revealed in their own language. No wonder this didn't work. These kind of relationships and marriages couldn't have worked because that is the ultimate dysfunctional family. If you've got people that are so far apart, not just in speech, but even in religion and in their faithfulness to God and their families, Amos 3:3 puts it this way, can two walk together except they be agreed? They were not agreed. Or maybe the husband was agreed and said, instead of following after Jehovah, the God of Israel, I will follow after the God of my wife. And so that is what happened. The sins of the fathers and the mothers affected the children's speech. And we see the dangerous result of this sin. You see, losing the language was not the only problem. It wasn't so much about losing the Hebrew tongue and learning the Hebrew language. You see, without the Hebrew language, they would have lost their legacy. God gave them a distinctive language and a distinctive family. It was one that grew in the area of Egypt. As they were separated there from the Egyptians, and they were learning and they were growing as a nation, as a people of God, as they went through the wilderness, ultimately reaching Israel, they were different than the rest of the people there. And part of that difference was the language that God provided for them. It was a dangerous thing because also without the language, they would lose their law. You see, the law of God was given to them in their Hebrew language. And so very often those languages may not have been able to translate the law into theirs. Or maybe they didn't want to because they weren't following after that God. But ultimately, without that language, they could have even lost the Lord Himself. They would have strayed and fallen away from God and went and followed after other gods. Those are some of the dangerous results of this kind of thing. All from a speech, all from a different language, all from speaking a language from another country. Remember, that was a symptom of a deeper issue. It's a shame that children from Christian homes know more about the language of the world, and you know what I'm talking about, than the language of the Lord, which is, of course, the Word of God. Isn't that a shame? They can tell you what's on TV. They can tell you all the different actors. And they can tell you, sometimes quoting scripts of movies and TV shows because they've seen it over and over and over again. And they've got a great grasp and an understanding on the language of the world, but they don't have much of a grasp on the language of the Lord. We need to learn ourselves and teach others, especially our kids. And if you don't have kids within the church, there are kids within this church that you need to help teach the language of the Lord. Because this is what matters. This is what really counts. And though this language of the world is a problem, rather it is a symptom of a deeper issue and a deeper sin. You see, even the sins and the failures of the parents will affect our children and grandchildren, even great-grandchildren, in these kinds of ways. So how should we deal with the symptom? Second thing we see is the sentiment toward worldly language. The sentiment toward worldly language in verse 25. This is what Nehemiah, who was, as we already found out, a man of action. He says, I contended with them. And I cursed them and smote certain of them and plucked off their hair and made them swear by God. Nehemiah had a very strong response. But it wasn't just to the symptom. It wasn't just to the fact that these children were speaking the language of the world, but rather to the source of that problem. And that's how we need to deal with it as well. We need to have a strong response, not just at the language, but at the root cause of that language. If a child says something that is not right, we ought to stop it. We ought to say, no, that is a bad word. You should not talk that way. You should not say it in those terms. But then we also got to say, what's going on in your heart? We need to deal with a deeper issue because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so we see in Nehemiah's reaction a very strong charge. He said that he contended with them. He contended. Now we need to be careful in reading this verse, lest we think that Nehemiah was a hot-headed, out-of-control kind of character. If you read it in that light, you think, boy, I would not want to have been near Nehemiah on his bad days. But we need to make sure that we understand that his anger was a righteous kind of anger. Nehemiah, in fact, here in many areas is a type of Jesus Christ and his patience and the way he dealt with sin. Jesus even went out and cast out the people that were buying, selling, and trading in the temple, remember? And none of us would say, well, Jesus was hot-headed. He had a very short fuse. Wouldn't want to meet with him on a bad day. But that's not the case with Nehemiah either. You see, his response was according to the law. We need to realize that. Even though he took swift action, and that's what we need to do when we deal with sins and the symptoms of sin, we need to deal with it swiftly, but we must not deal with it sinfully. And I believe that we see in Nehemiah here a good way of dealing with sin in a swift way, but not a sinful way. We're going to see that when he contended with these people, it shows that there was no one innocent. None of the children of Israel were innocent in chapter 13. Because that word contended, we've already seen elsewhere in the chapter. If you look at verse 11, it says that he contended with the rulers. Then contended I with the rulers. Then drop down to verse 17. He says, then I contended, that same word, with the who? Nobles of Judah. And now here in this verse, 25, I contended with them, just the basic general people who were involved in this particular sin. It was a very strong charge. No one was innocent in chapter 13. Everyone had a sin they have to deal with because there's none righteous, no, not one. Every one of us have problems that we need to deal with. And there's problems that in my life that maybe you don't need to deal with, but there's problems in your life that maybe I don't need to deal with. But we all have a problem we need to deal with, and when you deal with it, we need to deal with it swiftly, but not sinfully. And then we find a strong conviction. It says that he cursed them. Nehemiah, in his authority, his position of authority, was the jury and the judge. He already saw it. There was no question that they had sinned. They were guilty, and so he cursed them. He said it was not in the form of a curse word that we would say, but it was a pronouncement of their guilt and their deserving of punishment and of judgment. There was no excuses for the inexcusable. There were no defenses for the indefensible. They had sinned and they deserved to be judged. It was a strong conviction. And also, it was a strong consequence. This is what he did. He smote them and plucked off their hair. Again, we got to consider this in context. He was doing this lawfully and righteously. He did it swiftly, but he did not do it sinfully. Now, he may have done it himself. I believe in his position he would have had others do it, because pulling out of the hair was a physical demonstration of the shame of someone's sin. And so this would have been done at other times as well. It wasn't that he was just fighting with them and being angry with them. He was doing it to display the shame that their sin brought not just on them, not just on their children, not just on their family, but on their entire nation and upon their God. And so the physical sentence and the physical shame that he performed on them was something they deserved, but it showed to the rest of the people and even the rest of the world that that was not the way they should have behaved. And then it comes to a strong command. He wanted them to stop. He wanted them to fulfill the righteousness of God. It says, and he made them swear by God. He commanded them to stop sinning and then to get right with God. Is this the sentiment that we have when we hear worldly language or bad language, especially out of children? There are some of us that think, well, that's no big deal. It's no big deal if someone does that on Facebook or does this in an email or accidentally blurts it out. No, Nehemiah is teaching us that this kind of worldly language is a big deal because it's a symptom of even a deeper problem. And we must not make light of that kind of conversation and those kind of languages. We need to make sure that we're dealing with the symptom as well as the source. And that leads us to point number three. In verse 25, it shows us the source of worldly language. Look again at Nehemiah's command. He said, I made them swear by God, saying, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons, nor take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves. This is a very clear command, isn't it? Very clear, but it reveals to us what they were doing. He told them to stop something that they were doing. And so this is the source. This was the deep problem that was the cause of these children speaking that worldly language. The worldly language was reflecting the worldly lifestyle in the heart of their parents. And so we find the real deep issue. What were the people doing? What were the parents doing? We see that they were giving in to the attraction of the world. His command was, you shall not give your daughters unto their sons. There was some attraction. There was some attraction, desire for them to give their daughters to the sons of these worldly individuals or worldly nations that they were not supposed to intermarry with. There was some sort of attraction, but we're not sure what it was, but that attraction was obviously strong, and it was obviously stronger than their attraction to the Lord because they disobeyed Him. They were giving in to the attraction of the world, and that needed to be dealt with in the heart. And so often we as parents or grandparents or just people of God are attracted by the world. And so often we give things over to the world because we're attracted by it. And that's going to show up in our language. That's going to show up in how we live in our lifestyle. But then we also see this problem in that they were giving in to the admission of the world into their own lives. Not just giving in to the attraction of the world, but then saying, hey, why don't we invite the world into our life, admit them into our life, because it says they were getting the daughters of the heathen nations for their own sons. He says, don't take their daughters unto your sons or for yourselves, because that's what they were doing. Again, they were not obeying the express word of God. And instead, they were probably being pragmatic. Well, got to get a wife from somewhere. And there's not too many Jewish wives here. There's still quite a few in Babylon. Where are we going to go? They were pragmatic. They think, well, as long as it works. But that led to the language that we see in these verses. Our words can be used as a thermometer of our spiritual condition. We put the thermometer out to see what temperature it is. We got an upright freezer a few months ago, and I wanted to make sure that it was going to work. And so I found one of my son's little thermometers from his toys, and I stuck it in the freezer just so I would know how cool it got. And I would look at it periodically, and finally, I don't know, it broke or something. But the thermometer tells us how cold or how hot something is. Your tongue, your speech, the speech of others will tell us what kind of spiritual condition they have in their heart. It also will reveal our relationship with the world. If we speak like the Lord would have us to speak, it shows that we're close to the Lord. If we have the speech that is a worldly style speech, it's going to show that we're close to the world. Are we giving in to the attraction of the world and this admission of the world into our lives and our families and our churches? Some of the easiest ways to do this is through the media, through television, through internet, through radio, through music, through books, through magazines, all these different things we need to control, because if we admit the world into our life so much, we're going to start sounding like the world. And in doing so, we will lose that spiritual distinction. We need to identify that source of worldly language. There's something deeper going on. But then, point number four, we need to see the solution to worldly language. And this is where we're going to end up in verses 26 and 27. He asks the people that were offending in this sin. He said, didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Don't you remember your history lessons? You know, if you don't listen to history, you're condemned to repeat it. Listen, didn't Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these same things? Yet among many nations there is no king like him, it says. He was beloved of his God, and even God made him king over all Israel. But nevertheless, even Solomon did outlandish, or these strange women, cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God in marrying strange wives? What is it going to take to solve this kind of worldly outbreak, to deal with the symptom and the source of worldly language? See, a few things. It's going to take a simple honesty. A simple honesty. He asked them a very clear, obvious question. Didn't Solomon, the king of Israel, sin by these same things? Didn't he have a bunch of wives? How many wives did he have? 300 wives and 700 concubines. Wow. And they weren't all Jews. They were from all sorts of countries. In fact, one of his wives was from Egypt. And that was a very unusual thing for the Egyptians, to give a princess to another foreign ruler. But that's how highly thought of Solomon was. He had 300 wives, 700 concubines, many of which were from another country. He was wise in the ways of the world, and this was some of the politics of the time. In order to ally yourself with another country, you take a wife from that country or a princess, and then that would show your alliance with this nation. And so again, it's very pragmatic, but it's something the Lord said, no, don't do this. Don't do this. You have major problems if you do this. We've already seen some of those. So there needs to be a simple honesty. The answer to this question, of course, is yes. Solomon had some problems. He sinned by these things. And we see that the problem that the people had in this time is the same problem that they had throughout their history. Solomon had this problem. Others persistently have had this problem. And we need to have a simple honesty when it comes to these root sins in our life. We need to be honest about who we are before God. We need to be honest about our weaknesses. This opens up to the idea of accountability and transparency. We need to realize that I have problems. Maybe I have a certain bent towards sin and I need help in this area. You've got to be honest with yourself if you're going to deal with sin. If you can't do it on your own, you need help. You've got to be honest with yourself. A simple honesty. And then it's going to take a sincere humility. Here's the idea in verse 26. If a man like Solomon could fall into this kind of sin, then who do you think you are to think that you won't fall into this kind of sin? I mean, look at Solomon. He was the king. And yet he had these issues. We think that we can control this. We need to be humble. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, "Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth, take heed lest he fall." And then he talks about how special Solomon was in verse 26. Verse 26, it says that he was a special king. There was a special recognition by God. It says that he, yet among many nations, there was no king like Solomon. He was special. He was a success. But still he sinned. He even had a special relationship with God in verse 26. It says, who was beloved of his God. He was loved and given great privileges. Remember the story where he was having a dream and God asked him, Solomon, what do you want? The whole world. And I'll give it to you. Anything. And he asked for wisdom. And then God said, since you asked for wisdom, I'm going to give you everything. What a privilege Solomon had. And yet, he blew it. He still sinned. And he was special also in the responsibility from God. It says that God made him king over all Israel. He was special. Yet he failed and he sinned. It goes on in verse 26, nevertheless, even though of all the special advantages that Solomon had, nevertheless, even him did outlandish or strange women, these foreign wives, cause him to sin. If that can happen to Solomon, don't you think that can happen to us? Obviously not marrying those kind of wives, but adopting a worldly lifestyle and a worldly practice. We need to be humble and not to think that we are different than Solomon and think that we can handle these sins, because without God and His strength, we can't. And then it's going to take a sensitive heart. We need to see and feel what sin really is. In verse 27, he asks this question, shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God and marrying strange wives? I hope that that really cut them to the heart. They needed to have a sensitive heart to see that what they were doing was, as it says in verse 27, this great evil. Do you know that sin is a great evil toward God? Not just the big sins, every sin, all sin, is a great evil in the sight of God. And if we truly have this simple honesty and this sincere humility and then this sensitive heart, then and only then can we be restored to usefulness for God. And we need to remember that all this started because the children were heard speaking another language. It's amazing where it ended up. But it was the language of the world. So we see from this that our words do reveal something about us. Think about the thermometer of your spiritual condition right now, your tongue, your words, your speech. If there's something deeper that needs to be dealt with, we know what we say and how we say it. There's something deeper. Is it just a symptom of something that needs to be dealt with? Paul puts it this way in Ephesians 4:29, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good, to the use of edifying and building others up, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. This is the language that we need to speak. And that's the kind of language that needs to come from our hearts.